Nurses and Hypochondriacs, the podcast that brings nurse experts, patients, and hypochondriacs together to discuss hot topics in healthcare. And here is your host, Ercilia Pompilio.
Are you listening? Can you hear me? Can you hear me now? What would you rather lose, your hearing or your vision? Most people might say their hearing, but I guarantee you, after this episode of the Nurses and Hypochondriacs podcast, you might just change your mind. I'm joined by my very special guest, David Owen. We're going to be talking about his book, Volume Control, Hearing in a Deafening World. It's a really great book, and David shares many stories, and we'll also talk about how hearing is so important in sports like hockey, golf, and tennis. We'll also be talking about what wax, earwax, cerumen, is really made up of. This is a super interesting episode, and you won't want to miss it. But first, a word from our sponsor. This episode was brought to you by Rogue Nurse Media, 501c3, and The Well-Written Nurse, empowering nurses and patients to tell their stories. Can you hear me, David? Can you hear me?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you, David. I can hear you, David. Well, welcome to the Nurses and Hypochondriacs podcast, David Owen.
Thank you. Thank you.
Awesome. So I was telling you a little bit about, and I sent you that email of how I serendipitously or synchronistically found your book. And I've had Dr. Bernard Beitman on my show, who wrote a book on synchronicity. I had him in like 2019 or so. And basically, I was having problems with people listening to me lately. One person in particular, I have a project that I'm launching, and it's actually a magazine. I live in Palm Springs, California, and I'm launching a new magazine. So I was bringing her on as an associate editor, and I had several meetings with her. In one of the meetings, she had this baby, and I thought it was so interesting how she was holding the baby, almost like the baby was a rag doll of sorts. And I was really watching her, and I've never seen a mom hold a baby like that. And I've seen mothers hold thousands of babies in my career of 30 years as a pediatric nurse practitioner. And I just was like, something's just off. Why is she holding the baby that way? And so we were having a series of meetings over the year regarding this project. And in one meeting, she told me that, oh, I'm sorry I haven't contacted you. I've had this really terrible ear infection. You must think it's weird that an older adult has an ear infection. She's like, but when I was like 19 in college, I had 20 ear infections and kept getting the same antibiotic. Like, she was on amoxicillin. I had already found your book at the Dollar Tree in Palm Springs, which has amazing book selection that I'm always rummaging through and bringing them. You know, I have like a free library in my clinic. And so I'm always trying to look for books for the kids. And, you know, I had the book on my coffee table because I was like, oh, this looks like a really interesting book. I'm sure it could help me. And I flipped it to the page, to the perfect page, where you started to talk about antibiotics and its effects on hearing, like how streptomycin really messes up your hearing. And I was like, oh my God, that's it. That's it. Like, you answered my question synchronistically. I mean, it was crazy. I was like, that's it. She has some type of inner ear issue, which I think it's like affecting her eighth cranial nerve or whatever, or something's going on, which affects her balance, which is why she was awkward, you know, holding her baby. She's very loud. She's very kind of out of sorts. So it's so interesting, but that's how I found you. So tell us a little bit about yourself and how you wrote this awesome book, Volume Control, Hearing in a Deafening World. And I'll hold it up here. It's like trying to see it right here. But yeah.
I've been a magazine and book writer for a long time. I'm a staff writer at The New Yorker and have been since 1991. And I've written books about a lot of different things. I know a little bit about a lot of different things. And
I love it.
The hearing book was it began as an article at The New Yorker. It was suggested by an editor. I had some family interest. My grandmother was very hard of hearing. She lost hearing, especially on one side, when she was a teenager, and a young man took her out on a date. They went duck hunting in a boat, and he aimed his shotgun by resting it on her shoulder and fired. And that was it. I mean, it's catastrophic, incredibly loud, and that close to her ear. It's bad if you're just holding it, but if you're just a hunter, but if you're basically holding up the gun, then it's even worse. And so she struggled through her whole life with terrible hearing problems, which got worse. And I have tinnitus, ringing in the ears, which started, I'm not sure there was a connection, but I'd spent a week in China and I got the worst cold I've ever had. And when the cold finally went away, like a month later, I noticed that there was this ringing in my ears, which didn't go away. And I went to my doctor and he said, tinnitus is almost always, or maybe even always, accompanied by some hearing loss, at least. And so anyway, he gave me a little simple test. He hit a tuning fork and held it up and told me to tell him when I couldn't hear it anymore. And after he'd held it for a while, he leaned forward because he couldn't hear it anymore. We were both about the same age. We're both about, I'm 69. He's about the same age. So I had some interest, and it's really interesting because hearing is incredibly interesting, and it's sound is interesting. And so I followed all those things. And I would say, just say the woman you knew, I would say that amoxicillin is unlikely to be the cause of her hearing problems, but she was probably what she was being treated for when she was 19, some kind of repeated ear infections, was more likely to be the cause of the problem later. It's probably, you know, it could be damage, that just continuing damage.
Sure. Like, but what hit me, it was probably not the amoxicillin. What hit me was like, wait a minute, there's some type of damage going on.
Right.
Because she should have had tubes put in her ears. And that's what I told her. Yeah, there's so many things. And I told her now, I was like, I would go and really go get treatment or see like a naturopath or something. You know, you need to go see an ear specialist. And she tells me, oh no, like she totally blew it off. Yeah. Which is what you talk about in your book, which is so interesting.
Now, people they tend not to take hearing problems as seriously as they take vision problems. The real problems from early antibiotics like streptomycin, which was the first treatment for tuberculosis, and it had to be administered over a long period of time, and it is one of a number of drugs and substances that are what are ototoxic, that damage the hearing apparatus inside the brain. And there are many others, even, you know, something as simple as aspirin, and then many industrial chemicals, bad drugs that, you know, OxyContin, but there's the hearing system is incredibly sensitive and tiny and well protected inside the head, but it's susceptible to damage from all kinds of different things. And the main damage that most of us inflict on it, it comes from sound. You know, it's exposure to loud sound. Maybe people are less careless now than they were when I was growing up. When I was growing up, you know, we went to rock concerts. I mowed lawns without any kind of hearing protection. When we went to concerts, we always tried to sit as close as we possibly could to the speakers so that they would be really, really loud. At home, I listened to music. I tilted two speakers over my head and listened to it that way, and just turned it up as loud as I could stand it. So it's amazing. It's amazing that any of us can hear anything at all. And I spent a number of years working on my house, and I never wore hearing protection when I was using power tools. And one thing you notice is that, if you hire a carpenter who's now in his 50s or older, he almost always has some hearing loss. People are negligent. They're actually more careful now. Now, as you sort of walk around your neighborhood and you see people working in somebody's yard, they're much more likely than they were even 10 years ago to be wearing some kind of hearing protection. You still see people using chainsaws and leaf blowers and lawnmowers without any protection at all, but you're much, 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 much more likely to see even people who don't necessarily look as though they take very good care of themselves, you know, taking more care of their ears. So there's knowledge that's gotten around. People are more aware of the potential problems than they used to be.
It's so interesting. Going back to the story of your grandmother, it reminds me of that song, the famous song that Nancy Sinatra sang, Bang Bang, She Shot Me Down, right? I just went to a fashion show this weekend here at the Palm Springs Art Museum, and they kept playing that song like three times. The first time it was the Frank Sinatra version, which I had never heard before, and they did this ballet to it, and then they played the actual Nancy Sinatra version, because Nancy Sinatra lives here now in Palm Springs. I mean, uh-huh. Frank Sinatra is famous for Palm Springs. He's very famous out here. He's done a lot of philanthropic work. And but the interesting thing was, I did a deep dive into this song right when I was rereading the first chapter of your book last night. And I was like, wait a minute, this is so interesting. Bang, bang, she shot me down, you know, and the whole gunpowder thing. And then I, like I said, I was doing a deep dive into the song. Excuse me. And it turns out Sonny Bono actually wrote the song for Cher. And Cher was the first one who sang it. And Sonny Bono used to be the mayor of Palm Springs. So I'm like, this... It's like this whole song originated in Palm Springs for some reason, but it is very, very interesting because you talk about the whole gunpowder deafness and how gunpowder, you know, was originated in China, I also have tinnitus, where you got your tinnitus from, which is pretty interesting. So do you want to just jump into gunpowder deafness, which I think was very interesting, and fireworks? Because I know, like, fireworks are such a thing. You want to hear the pop. In Italy, where my mom is from, she's from Bari, Italy, a place called Caneto Mondrone, which they have this festival in November for this one saint. His name is Saint Trifone. And they have like this, it's all about fireworks for like a weekend, like nonstop, 24 hours for like 3 days. And even in the daytime, you can't see anything, but people love to hear the pop of the fireworks, you know, and it's so crazy. And people will just go out to the fields and watch just smoke, you know, but they love to hear the boom, you know? So let's talk about that.
Yeah. Well, you imagine the world before, when there was the only humans were very primitive, for a long time, there were no really loud sounds in the world, you know, like thunder, but nothing like what we're exposed to now. And two of the big changes were the Industrial Revolution, with these big, very loud machines, and the invention of gunpowder. And one of the things I wrote about in the book is that you know, people talk about the Civil War as a sort of watershed moment in military history. It was kind of the first modern war, and that casualties were what they were because people's understanding of warfare had not evolved to the same point that their ability to make incredibly destructive weapons had. And it's actually something that happens over and over again in human history. The First World War was even worse on soldiers' hearing. You know, even now, it's amazing. This is a problem that should have been obvious a couple of hundred years ago, and yet there's really still the number one and number two health related claims by veterans and to the Veterans Administration are tinnitus and hearing loss, and
wow,
service related injuries And because of everything you do, and even though there's awareness of hearing protection, I've talked to soldiers who said that, you know, during training, for example, using hearing protection was discouraged. It was, you know, sort of too soft.
Wow.
And yet, if you're a soldier, you need to be able to hear what your commanding officer is yelling at you. Functioning ears have military value, but the military has not really dealt with that still. And there was a recent lawsuit that the manufacturer of hearing protection that was used until relatively recently, it was a big class action lawsuit that it was hearing protection, but it didn't work very well. And there were soldiers who were deaf and despite it. But you see it, you know, you see it everywhere. If you watch the NFL, if you watch football games, there are a couple of stadiums. My hometown stadium, Arrowhead Stadium in Kansas City, is one of the very worst. And in Seattle, where the fans are actually proud of, pushing the noise level, the crowd noise level, what's really past the damage threshold, well past the damage threshold, and you'll see a decibel reading given on the television screen. This is how loud the fans are, and they think of it, they're contributing to the game by making it hard for the other team to hear signals from the quarterback and things like that. But it's, you know, you if you go to one of those games, if you have season tickets, that's probably one of the worst things you could be doing, is this repeated exposure to sound levels that are well above the level at which sustained exposure causes permanent hearing loss. You will sometimes see now when, you know, football players' families in the stadium, their little kids will be wearing
ear protection. I've seen that.
Or you see it at rock concerts, the children of rock musicians. I remember one of the first children at a rock concert that I saw wearing hearing protection was Kurt Cobain's daughter, there with her mother, and she was wearing hearing protection. But really, people, grown-ups who go to those concerts should have be wearing pretty significant hearing protection too. Almost any hunter will have suffered some hearing loss. Hunters tend to view wearing hearing protection as counterproductive. You know, I can't hear a deer walking through dry leaves if I'm wearing hearing protection. But of course, if you deafen yourself, you can't hear those things either. And they're very, like in the Cabela's catalog, there are some good electronic hearing devices that allow you to hear, even to hear better when you're not firing, but at the within a tiny, tiny fraction of a second of firing, they shut down. So you sort of have it both ways. It protects your ears from the damaging sound of the gunfire, but makes it possible to hear other things. So every hunter should wear those at least, and ideally they should wear stuff in their ears and then something over their ears, over the head, over the ear, hearing protection too, because it's very, very loud.
Interesting. Also, like war veterans and PTSD from the loud bangs, because they can be out in the world, like after they've gone to war, and they'll hear a car backfiring, you know,
right,
and that'll trigger this PTSD response. I remember I was dating an FBI agent, and he was undercover with the Italian mob in Naples. I've dated so many very interesting men. And we were walking in North or West Hollywood one day, and he was infiltrating the Gomorrah mafia, and he was there for about almost 2 years, and they pulled him out, right? And so we were walking to West Hollywood, and a car just like backfires. He just flipped out. You know, he was just like, you know, and I was like, are you okay? You know, but he just was so traumatized. I mean, they had put him at the airport. Like checking, that's how he's like, I got an airport job now, you know, and he was upset because of his PTSD and everything he'd gone through. But it's very pronounced, so, and also very interesting. But yeah, so I also want to talk about there's so many great things to talk about. I don't know. I want to talk about listening and hearing, and also conductive hearing loss and earwax. Of course, I've found I haven't found, you know, over the years, you'd think I would find very interesting things in ears. I think I found a raisin, a little bead. I have found Play-Doh. I mostly deal in pediatrics. Those are the right things. Earwax, I find, is very, very interesting. And you write about it in your book. It is like this sticky substance consists of secretions from the glands that line the external ear canal, plus dead skin cells, odds and ends. It protects the eardrum from trapping and gradually jetsoning. I love that.
Jetsoning, yep.
Jetsoning insects, dirt and miscellaneous small intrusions, and also by acting as a mild antimicrobial. People get really weirded out by wax. They think it's like a nuisance, like feces, and it's right. not, you know.
It's
and
not I even wax. It's not even real wax.
It's like a combination of all these very interesting things that our body secretes. And because a lot of times when I get parents are like, that earwax is so annoying. And why does it happen? Because they're thinking it's feces. Like even the other day, I was watching this TikTok where a nurse was like, oh, you could put Colace in the ears and get all the earwax out. And so I interjected and I was like, don't tell people to do. I go, first of all, you need a doctor's order. And I guess they do this in the ER to get it fast, you know, but I go, in all of my time as a nurse, I've never had to use Colace. I use hydrogen peroxide, you know, water, and it comes out fine. I mean, sure, maybe there are those weird cases, you know, and maybe in the ER, or I think it's always like an ER doctor that's trying to be a cowboy, you know, and we'll do that. But I was just like, don't tell people to do this. You know, I think you think it's cool because it's feces. But I think this brings us to a good discussion here about earwax, you know, what it really is. Because I mean, parents get so grossed out, or they get very interested. Like when I pull out a bunch of earwax, they'll be like, ooh, this is so cool. I had a woman that was putting it through her kid's earwax or her fingers and putting and just, you know, touching it because of the consistency. And she couldn't stop touching it. It was very fascinating. But
I think, you know, earwax is how ears clean themselves. So most of the problems that people get into with earwax are caused by their efforts to deal with earwax. So you pack it in, but you know, you do the thing you're not supposed to do with
the Q-tip,
you kind of pack it in, or you do one of these really horrifying things where you stick something in your ear and then set it on fire and supposedly will draw out the earwax and all these
things. Oh, that's right. Yes.
There are lots of candling of earwax.
Yes, candling. Yes, yes.
But all those things are crazy. Now, there are people who have, sometimes they have their, they secrete a lot of it, or they have an oddly shaped ear canal, and it can, if it accumulates, or if they've jammed it in themselves, it blocks sound from getting to the eardrum. And so then it can be removed. But most of us would be much better off if we just forgot about it, and it takes care of itself. It works its way out. It's water soluble. It dries and flakes away, and it's not a big deal. But there are, you know, one person I wrote about who was somebody who, like the person you were talking about, who had repeated ear infections, and it was a child who had many, 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 many ear infections, and so many that it had actually damaged her eardrum, and she had, so sound wasn't getting through to the inner ear. She had really severe conductive hearing loss, and it, as often happens, I'm sure you've seen this in your practice, where it goes undetected, where doctors aren't looking for hearing problems, and there's, or they check when a baby, you know, newborns are usually checked for hearing loss or little simple tests.
Right. They do the Bayer exam when they're born. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And then often not again. And it can have, New York City stopped requiring mandatory hearing tests at various stages throughout education, because they said, well, after birth, they're tested at birth. And after that point, it's usually caused by just, you know, something like accumulations of earwax. But even so, whatever the reason is that a child can't hear what's going on in class, something should be done about it. And exactly. Very often there are kids who have hearing problems that are undiagnosed. And then the assumption is that there's some kind of mental
psychological
impairment.
Right.
And they end up in, you know, they end up in special ed, and they must be autistic. They must have this, they must have that. And all it was is, or the source of all those problems was an undiagnosed hearing loss. And so I would think that a medical professional, a pediatric medical professional, anytime there's a concerns about like delayed milestones or anything like that, the first check is to see how's this child's hearing. Is the child hearing the world? Because it's, you know, that it's you can cause permanent damage if a child is not hearing things well during the period when, for example, they're acquiring language, which needs, you know, some kind of input, either you know, through hearing or through sign language or something, to take advantage of that window when the brain is especially receptive to language formation. I've watched it in my children and in my grandchildren. It's miraculous. You can't understand it, how these little people who aren't very old at all suddenly are doing this incredibly complicated thing of communicating and having acquiring language. And when children miss that opportunity because they can't hear, or because their hearing problem hasn't been diagnosed and they haven't been given a way to compensate for it, it's tragic, because after a certain point the brain is not as receptive to those inputs as it is when they're very young.
That's an excellent point that you bring up. And I think that, like, when I first started practicing as a nurse practitioner in 2005, we used to do a hearing exam all the time on the kids, and that was part of our physical exam. Many places got rid of it because I don't think that it's mandatory anymore. But what have we seen an uptick in? We've seen more of an uptick in kids with mental health problems, you know, psychological problems, ADHD. But you think, could it really be hearing? And because we've now gotten rid of this, and all of a sudden we're seeing an uptick in ADHD and all these other issues, you know, which, like I said, your book has been so enlightening to me, where I'm like, you know what, I'm going to push to get hearing exams. Like I had a patient where he was having all these behavioral issues, and I started to really look at him and the way he speaks, because I would be quite a bit of a distance from him and I'd tell him something and he'd be like, what? And then I told his mom, I was like, you know, I think I need to send him for a hearing exam. It could be it. And I had just read your book, you know, and she's like, no, he just doesn't listen. He has selective hearing. I go, no, I would still kind of take him, because I think there's something going on. And I have the privilege of seeing this kid almost like on a daily basis, because his mom works at one of the clinics. And I'm just like, you know, I'm watching him and I'm watching him more. And I go, and I kind of told her again, I think we should send him, you know, to get a hearing test and stuff. But she's like, no, he just doesn't listen.
Yeah, I think, it's too bad, because it's, you saw all the symptoms right there. It's clear that his problem was not a listening problem. It was a hearing problem. I mean, he wasn't not paying attention to you. He was trying to pay attention to you and he couldn't hear what you were saying. I do have friends who have, you know, I have one guy I play golf with. We're all late 60s, early 70s. And there are a number of hearing problems in that group. And there's one who, people often say they think he has hearing problems. They said, no, what he really has, he's really hard of listening and he doesn't listen. But sometimes it's both, you know, there's people who don't hear and also don't listen, or they didn't listen, or each problem makes the other worse. But you certainly notice that people are more attuned to noticing it when they're older, but the time when it really makes sense to pay attention to it is when kids are really young. And I think the things that you notice, the speech difficulty, the inability to hear what you were saying, those are clear signs that something's not getting through.
Right, and, for sure. And but providers nowadays, sorry to cut you off, but providers nowadays only have 10 to 15 minutes with kids, you know, and sometimes, you know, it's so hard. Like back in the day, I used to see about 30 to 60 kids a day. But we would still get this hearing exam. We had the little machine. You put, you know, the medical assistant would put them on the machine. If they failed, they would go just to see the audiologist, you know. And I remember sending lots of kids to see the audiologist. But nowadays, if you're not testing for it, you know, and then you're just throwing these kids through and you only have a certain amount of time to see these kids. And sometimes you don't see them again for another year. They're getting lost, you know, unfortunately, and probably placed in places where they don't need to be placed, you know, in school.
No, or they just have trouble, you know, they just don't do as well in school as they would if they, if somebody had recognized the problem. And it's, you know, you've seen it in your practice, I'm sure, how many kids get ear infections all the time. And if they get them, truly get them all the time, it can cause hearing loss. And it, and even when it's, you know, even when it resolves itself, still during that period when they can't hear, they're not going to do as well at school as they would otherwise. So, and I think it's also, you see in your practice, you see kids, they come in because they have a problem, and if it's you know, they have a bad cold or they have ear infection, they're going to have trouble hearing, and you don't necessarily know that when that ear infection or cold goes away, they're still going to have trouble hearing. It's too bad. And school systems they're always trying to cut back on the money they spend. And an easy way to do that is just to test hearing less. When in fact, since it's one of the, you know, because it has such profound impact on kids' ability to function in school, it's the kind of thing that should be tested all the time.
I totally agree with you. I mean, one of the things that you brought up about your golf friend who, and I love how you wrote a lot about golf, because, you know, hearing is so finite. Like when you're playing sports, I just went to the Paribas Open here in Indian Wells, and it's the first days when they're just having the practice sessions. And it's like just hearing the ball volley back and forth and that pop, you know, is just so interesting and satisfying. Like as an athlete, you need to listen to all these little things, like even the swishing of the golf club next to the ball, which happens after, right? It's not happening while you're swinging, but it comes like later, you know, in that little pop that you hear of the golf club hitting the ball. And if your hearing is poor, I mean, that's going to be less. It's like, how good of an athlete are you really going to be if you can't pay attention to those fine tunes, right? Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it was Golf Digest did an experiment. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't a double blind peer reviewed scientific experiment, but what they found was that hearing is incredibly important to golf, and you wouldn't think it for the reason you say. All the sound, what you hear, takes place after you've hit the ball. So how could it possibly affect? But they found that people hit the ball when they couldn't hear, they didn't hit the ball as well as they did when they could, and also that their long putting was worse when they couldn't hear. And Arnold Palmer, who had began losing his hearing fairly early in his life, said that he couldn't play golf if he didn't have his hearing aids on. And there was a hockey coach who read the Golf Digest article and conducted a similar unscientific, unpeer-reviewed, but still very interesting study with hockey players, and found the same thing, that if you block the ears of hockey players, they had a much harder time playing, hitting the puck. So I think we underappreciate the complexity of all our senses and how they work together. And in many ways, and I think there's sort of scientifically, there's more appreciation now than there once was, but hearing and seeing are connected in the brain, and they work together in very surprising ways. And you know, tennis too, there's a, if you look, you know, you don't, it's very hard to be deaf and to perform at a high level in tennis, golf, hockey, any of those things. There have been deaf tennis players who've learned to compensate by picking up information visually that players typically unconsciously pick up through their ears, and they can can compensate. But still, there's not, you know, there's not in the very top ranks in the world, there are no deaf players. It's a challenge. It makes those difficult physical activities much more difficult. And in order to make up for the loss of the information that you gain, that a hearing person gains their hearing, they have to devise other ways of doing the same thing. So there have been, you know, a good tennis player will see things in the flight of a ball, in the spin of a ball, that a hearing player won't even know exist, because the hearing player can hear things that the deaf player cannot. But it makes you appreciate the contribution that hearing plays to activities that you wouldn't think it had anything to do with, including just walking. You know, you get a lot of information. You get a lot of information feedback on walking just from what it sounds like. And if you can't hear, it becomes much more difficult to just put one foot in front of the other and not trip and, you know, and keep from falling on your face.
And nowadays, everybody has like earbuds in. I mean, I know, I know when I get patients in, they're here for a physical exam and they have their earbuds in. I was like, hello, you know, I'm like, I don't even know. Sometimes they have long hair and I go to check their ears and they have earbuds in. I was like, how do you expect me to check your ears? So, but can you imagine if somebody has their earbuds in all the time? Another thing I want to bring up too is maybe the reason why, because I'm having a problem lately with people hearing me, you know, or listening to what I'm saying. And I think that's one of the most frustrating things for me is when I'm not heard. And one of the things that I started to kind of think about this morning is, well, nobody really talks on the phone anymore either, right? It's most of our communication is through text message. So it's almost like people are forgetting to hear or forgetting to listen, you know, or just, you know, I don't know. I've kind of have had this problem in dating, and I was kind of thinking about it. Is that why people ghost? Because they're not really listening to people. Like, there's so much going on in a person's voice. There's like tonation. You could sense someone's mood very differently. I'm very clairaudient. I can hear just frequencies in people's voice and tone. Like I know when someone's lying by just their tone. Like it just, there's something in me. I'm listening and there's something that happens. I can't even quite explain it. But then it just, I get so like anger, like I'm like something in me just like shifts and I'm like, I know you're lying, you know. And I've talked about this with a few people, and Dr. Ran Anbar, he's a pulmonologist pediatrician that was on my show, and he's talks about hypnotherapy. I just had a session with him and I was just like, I noticed this happening. And he's like, oh, you're just very psychic, you know, you just are very, that's just your clairaudience, like kind of like your superpower in a way. But and I can really hear, I mean, I know in your book you pick up like the vibrations and stuff, which I'm very sensitive to vibrations. I, you know, working in pediatrics, there's a lot of noise sometimes. And I remember I had a townhome that was connected to another wall, and I just, you know, people's music next door and TV just sent me crazy. I just drove me nuts, you know, just when I'm trying to relax and all of a sudden you hear these crazy vibrations and stuff. Do you want to kind of talk about a little bit of the inner ear and the hearing and the whole invention of the hearing aid? Because I remember as a kid, we used to see those cartoons with the guy putting that cone shaped thing or next to his ear, you know,
an ear trumpet. Yeah.
An ear trumpet. That's right. That's right. Those people actually used to use those. Those weren't just in cartoons, right?
Right. They work. No, and they work too. You can do it by cupping your ears too. If you can't hear a conversation that's going on the other side of the table, you can, cause it, you know, it makes it pot. You get more of the sound into your ears. The first hearing aids were really pretty crude and huge. They were gigantic. And, you know, when kids had them, you know, you had headphones on and you had to carry around a big device and a battery pack, and there was a special harness that you would do it, or it would be something that would put it on a table. Now they're miraculous. This incredibly powerful technology that runs on extremely low voltage, and fits inside your ear, and what's really a very hostile environment for electronics. It's warm and it's damp.
Got the earwax.
Right. It's all this. It's a tough place to put a piece of electronics. And every time, you know, a company like Apple or Bose or a company that's not one of the big hearing aid manufacturers, they decide this is a huge, you know, these things sell for thousands. This is a huge market. Let's get into it. And then they discover that it's incredibly hard. It's incredibly hard to make a good functioning hearing aid. A difficulty that people have with hearing aids is they, you know, I have glasses. I got them in fifth grade. I couldn't believe the change. You know, I had never realized that when you looked at a tree, you could see individual leaves, that it wasn't just a big, green mass. The detail that I could see, the blackboard that I could see at school, it was huge. You know, I went from having poor vision to having perfect vision, which is what happens when you put on glasses. Hearing aids is different. People expect it to be the same, and it's not, because one reason is that if you lose the ability to hear certain frequencies because you've damaged that part of the inner ear, you can't get it back.
Right.
So if it's weakened, you can make sound at that frequency louder so that you have a better chance of hearing it. But it's not the same. You don't, putting in a hearing aid is not the same sort of transformative experience that putting on a pair of glasses is. The brain also has to get used to a new way of hearing when you put in hearing aids. And so you'll often hear, you know, you call an older parent, they say, wait a minute, I have to go get my hearing aid.
Right.
Well, they should be wearing it all the time, because it's as though they're starting to wear hearing. Every time they put it in, they're starting from zero again. And what they really need to do is be training their brain to interpret sound in this new way, with the amplification, in the frequencies where they need it. And it's tough. You know, my wife and I went out to dinner with, just a couple of weeks ago it was three couples, everybody's late 60s, early 70s. And one of the main topics of conversation was hearing. Only one of the people at the table had hearing aids. Like all restaurants now, it was incredibly loud, because the whole design aesthetic in restaurants now is hard surfaces. You know, the kitchen is open so you can see it. So all the noise from the kitchen you can hear. Often there's music playing, and often there's music playing loud, because people who own restaurants have learned that if you make the music loud, people talk less, they drink more, and they leave sooner. So you turn the tables over faster. And there's also this sort of paradox that even people who hate loud restaurants are often suspicious of really quiet restaurants, because, like, how could it be any good? You know, it's as quiet as the grave in there. So,
yeah.
But restaurants are tough. And cocktail parties, I was interviewing people, interviewing friends, I said, how's your hearing? Oh, good. You know, oh, well, except, you know, at cocktail parties.
Yeah. And I have that problem at cocktail part, just anywhere where there's just a lot of people. I'm always like, I have to be right up to that person. Yeah.
And it's that's age related, among other things. And younger people are able to sort of basically hear what they want to hear in that situation and block out everything else. The way their brains work at that point they're much better suited to dealing with what's known in the hearing world as the cocktail party problem. And as we get older, we lose the ability to do that, in addition to very often losing our ability to hear the very frequencies at which conversation mostly takes place. And so those parties are not easy. And one of the sort of most devastating impacts of hearing loss, and you read about this all the time, is cognitive decline that goes along with it, isolation, social isolation. And what happens is, if you can't hear, you can't participate in conversations with other people, in social interactions with other people. So if you can't hear, people tend to withdraw from social interaction.
And they die faster, right? You right. Found it's, that yes, too.
It correlates with all kinds of mortality problems. So you want to stay on top of your hearing. I mean, I know somebody who has very severe hearing loss. People always assumed when they saw him in social gatherings that he was just a grumpy, mean person. But the real explanation was he couldn't hear what anybody was saying.
Wow.
And so he would, you know, just sort of, you know, look grumpy and sit off to the side and not respond to anything. Well, he couldn't, it was cacophony to him when he was in there, or quiet cacophony. He couldn't make sense of anything that anyone was saying. And I had this realization myself. There was an evening where my wife and I and several other couples, we had an evening it was a picnic at a lake. We're sitting at a picnic table. It was a beautiful, beautiful evening. And one of the kids always, would I rather be deaf or blind? My friends and I used to talk about this, deaf or blind. And almost always would say, oh, deaf, you know,
right.
I couldn't stand to be blind. But I realized at that meal, you know, if I were blind, I wouldn't be able to see all these beautiful things. I wouldn't be able to see the children playing in the lake or the sunset and all these things. But if I were deaf, I would have just been a lump on the end of the bench. I wouldn't have been talking to anybody. I wouldn't have had any idea what they were saying. And it would have been as though I wasn't there. So in terms of the impact on your life, and this is what Helen Keller always said, that of her two afflictions, deafness and blindness, the deafness was by far the worst because it blocked her from interaction with other human beings.
That is so interesting. I mean, it's really true. It's like we so take our hearing for granted, you know, and it's like you think about it. Would I want to be deaf or blind? And after reading your book, I would be like, I probably would choose blind. I mean, knock on wood.
Right. Reluctantly, but, right. Yeah. Right.
But all right. of the little nuances that you would not be able to hear, and all the finite, like I was sitting having coffee outside this morning, and there's a lot of hummingbirds here where I live. It's a little bit rural where I live, and this hummingbird just came. They come right up to my face sometimes, and you can just hear the flap of their wings, and it's just so amazing. You know,
it's your red glasses. Your red
I
glasses.
Know it's you my red like glasses. Yeah. Well, I was reading 1984 at one point, and they would. It's a red book with a bullseye on it. It would just come right up to it. Like every morning, I would sit up there to read it. I would just get one in my face. Like I would be like, dude. You know,
that's great.
Like,
that's great.
Watch it. But yeah, one of the things, you know, that's really popular right now is ASMR. Do you know what that is? Like they're making videos. So it's autonomous sensory meridian response. So these people will make these videos and they're very popular. And it's either people tapping on stuff with their nails, it's whispering, and what it's supposed to do, it kind of starts like a tingling sensation in your head that goes back to your neck. You know, maybe it's kind of like it has the same response as a tuning fork would, I guess. Mm-hmm. So it elicits this relaxation. I mean, it's not my thing. I think it kind of creeps me out when I see one of those videos. But I find it very interesting how people get so addicted to it, you know, and is it maybe because they're wanting to hear more, wanting to more pay attention to like hearing because they don't hear and because we're reading all the time, you know, with text messages and stuff like that. I mean, I don't know. I find that very, very interesting. So.
Yeah, I don't know. I've heard about it, but I haven't done it.
Yeah, it's not my thing. I don't know. It annoys me. So it has Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say something that's very interesting. Now, I have a friend who's a little older than I am. 40 years ago, he suddenly lost all hearing on one side. It's sudden one-sided hearing loss. And nobody really understands what causes it or what you can really do about it. But anyway, he became completely deaf on one side. And recently, within the past year, he had sudden one-sided hearing loss on the other side too. So now he's completely deaf. And the chance of that happening is minuscule. I mean, there's very little chance that losing one hearing on one side will happen to you. And the chance that having lost hearing on one side, you'll lose hearing on the other side too. It's so close to zero, you couldn't almost even calculate it. But he's lucky now there was a time when, you know, he would have been in the same situation that Helen Keller was in, where he just no access to anything. But now you can, you know, on his phone, his phone will transcribe what I say to him, or when we play bridge online, he has a program that transcribes, so he can respond just as though, you know, if you don't see him, that he's reading something, you would have no idea that he's not simply just taking part in a normal conversation.
Wow.
And so I think that technology is amazing. And COVID was a boost to that, because in COVID, when everybody was, you know, suddenly communicating as by Zoom as we are now,
right.
it gave a boost to software that people who could not hear could use to see, basically see closed captioning when they were talking with other people, which you can do it. It makes it possible to have normal conversations with people that are much more difficult, that would have been impossible without that technology. I mean, you can even, my wife's brother is married to a woman who speaks very little English. She speaks Russian. And but with Google Translate, they can have almost in real time.
Right.
Conversations. Like conversation. Pass the phone around. It translates. You can see it. And there's somebody, when I was working on my book, said, you know, there's never been a better time in human history to lose your hearing, because there's so many people who are working on technology, on medical solutions, on genetic solutions for people who have genetic hearing loss. There's huge amounts of money that are going into it, because the market
there's even the
huge
cochlear implants. We used to do a lot of cochlear implants when I worked at Children's Hospital.
Yeah.
A lot of microtia repair as well with the outer ear that does affect the hearing of the inner ear as well.
Yeah. There are many possibilities now with cochlear implants, which were was described to me by one scientist as the most amazing, the most incredible prosthetic device ever in history, and they keep getting better. It's pretty crude that it hugely reduces the amount of signal that goes into the brain, the amount of auditory signal that goes into the brain, and yet the brain is able to, with practice, make an extraordinary amount of sense from this very limited input. And it's another, you know, testament to the extraordinary power of the human brain. I think most people I know, if you haven't seen anything, read anything about it, or learned anything about it, or undergone it yourself, assume that if you give somebody a cochlear implant, you know, it just clicks their hearing back on. It's not true. It's a different way of hearing. It's a much reduced signal. But people who have them, they adapt in ways that almost defy belief, where it could be hugely beneficial. Now, my friend who has double-sided hearing loss, he has a little bit of hearing still on one side. So the question for him is, if he has the cochlear implant, that will go away, because you destroy, you know, what's there. It would mean depending 100% on his implant and giving up the hope that some of his hearing will come back, which is still remotely possible. But he's glad that option is there, because there's a chance that he could, even with a two-sided cochlear implants on both sides, he could come very back to functioning in company in some ways better than he was able to when he had only one good ear. You know, when he went out to dinner with people, he had to be sure that he sat on the correct side of whoever he sat next to, and he had to explain, you know, I can't hear you. He said the one good thing is, if he, you know, he could make a room. All he had to do was turn his good ear to the pillow when he was lying down. The room was quiet. And I said, oh, it's total silence. He said, well, no, it's not exactly total silence, because he has tinnitus in that ear, and now on both sides, which is common and if not universal in people with, when you lose hearing, it doesn't become a silent. You know, your brain.
You hear that buzzing of the cicadas. I love how you put that. I mean, here we have cicada season, July up until about October, November, which is pretty crazy. I had a friend come down, and he's never been to Palm Springs, and he was like, what is that noise?
Yeah, right. No, if it were coming from your neighbor's house alarm, you would call the police. But it's, I love it. I love that sound. I grew up with that sound.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing was that my tinnitus, it's there all the time. It's a high pitch, but I
Mine is too. Mine is there all the time, but
I don't notice it.
Me neither.
I seldom notice it. I'll go for days without noticing it at all. But when I did notice it was when I was working on the books, and all I'm thinking about was tinnitus. And so I heard it all the time. And I noticed it
more when I was reading your book.
Right. Of course. And I talked to a researcher who deals with veterans who have hearing problems, hearing loss, and tinnitus. And he said, maybe that their approach, you know, he would have tinnitus sufferers make a tinnitus diary. You know, you write down every day when you couldn't hear. He said, maybe that's just exactly the wrong approach. And it is because you're making these people, the only real cure for it so far is to train yourself not to be bothered by it. And if you're telling someone that they have to pay attention to it around the clock, you're undermining your own efforts to help them learn to ignore it.
I agree. I totally agree. Well, this has been a super fun conversation. I love this episode. This is so interesting. I learned so much from your book and from the conversation as well. Is there anything you want to add, and where can people find you? And where can they find your book? On Amazon, I know.
Yeah, right. On
your website. Yeah.
Yeah. The website is just davidowen.net. And the New Yorker. The thing I would say, never take medical advice from a freelance writer. So don't do anything because I suggest it. But the one thing I would say, and I would feel comfortable saying, is we should all be careful with our ears. Once you lose it, you can't get it back. And so I have, earplugs on my keychain, and I try to remember to protect my ears when I'm doing something loud. I certainly, when I'm using a lawnmower, when I'm, using a chainsaw or doing anything, I try to do it. And it amazes me that my ears still work as well as they do. I've had a small amount of hearing loss, age appropriate hearing loss, but not enough to wear the hearing aids that I got when I was researching my book. You know, I went to a hearing aid manufacturer and got the hearing aids and I wore them for a few days. But the one difficulty, if your hearing isn't bad enough yet, they made a kind of a swooshing sound that would modulate every time I made a sound. Like if I clicked a key on my typewriter, I talked to an audiologist about it. He said, that's because the hearing aid, it raises the volume when there's something to listen to.
Kind of like calibrating.
When you make a noise, it tunes up. But so if you can still hear pretty well, you hear it going up and down. And it was so annoying to me that I couldn't stand it, even for research. So I have them, like most people's hearing aids, they sit in a drawer waiting until I get to the point where I feel that I really need them.
Mm-hmm. Like I said, your book has been so, even now talking about the blow, the noise that you make with either a chainsaw or even the blowers, like here in California, everybody has those blowers. My mom is addicted to her blower, you know, and she has, poor hearing and stuff. She talks really loud. And now I'm thinking my neighbors, again, it's that they don't hear me. But they talk really loud, and he's always got his blower. So I go, I swear to God, the guy's probably got some hearing loss going on.
Oh yeah,
yeah,
undoubtedly. Yeah. Those machines are terrible. And people, when I was growing up, you walked around the neighborhood in the fall, you smelled burning leaves. Now you hear, really, from the day the snow melts till the day the following winter when the snow falls again, there's somebody nearby blowing leaves, and you get, it's so much a part of the background noise.
Oh yeah.
In suburbia now that you often don't even notice it. There was once I was with my friends on the golf course, and it sounded like a jet engine. It was like at a school, and they had some super, super powered leaf blower. And then it finally stopped, and we were, silence.
Oh, yeah.
But then after like 20 seconds, we realized, oh, that's not silence. Now we can hear the other leaf blowers that were going, that one was drowning out. And it's amazing. They're everywhere.
Yeah, especially here, like when I lived in Los Angeles, like they at North Hollywood, Burbank, synonymous for leaf blowers, like all the time.
Yeah, all the time.
It was so, so annoying, as much that this guy made a t-shirt that said North Hollywood on it with a leaf blower guy. Right. You know?
Nobody rakes anymore.
That's what North Hollywood for, and Burbank. Leaf blowers.
Right.
You know, it's just so, yeah. And
background
so
noise much, of.
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead.
I was just saying the background of American society. It's pretty much.
It's so true.
It hasn't always been true. It hasn't always been true. The worst are the gasoline powered ones, the two stroke engines. Those are.
But right. The electric ones are bad too. Banned them in Los Angeles.
Right. California's way ahead. Yeah. California's ahead of everybody else. But there's still the electric ones are terrible too.
Yeah. The electric ones are because they go, they have this weird up and down. I mean, oh, when I'm around my mom and I'm just like, oh, it's leaf blower time. Like every morning she has, and it's more of an addiction because I'm like, there's no leaves. What are you doing?
Yeah, right.
You know, it's all concrete.
You see them blowing one farther one and farther leaf. Away.
Yeah.
It would be easier to bend down and pick it up.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for being on the Nurses thank and you. Hypochondriacs podcast, David. Awesome. Thank you so much.
Uh-huh. Bye.
Wasn't that an interesting episode? I'm sure you learned something. We love our listeners here at the Nurses and Hypochondriacs podcast, and we'd love it if you did us a favor and gave us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts. We'd also love it if you throw us some change and gave us a donation. The link is at the end of this episode. You can go ahead and give us a donation on Venmo at Nurses and Hypocon or on our PayPal at the end of the show notes. Thanks for listening.